Hello, everyone. My name is James Ross Kiefer, and I just want to say welcome to the Carolinian Podcast. This is our first episode, and I'm very, very excited to bring this to you. First off, I just want to say thank you to everyone that's been a part of this. It's been a great week of just recording and editing and just hard work on everyone's part. It's the first episode, so some things may stay around, some things may not, but either way, I'm super proud of this, and I just want to say thanks again for everyone that's made this possible. For our first episode here, we've got a discussion on hate speech on college campuses. We have some commentary on Puerto Rico and the electricity crisis and how possibly Ryan Zinke may or may not be involved. We've got some commentary about the World Series and what to look forward with that. We've got some things highlighting Froggy Fresh, who is an internet celebrity who was here recently. And we also have an interview with a professor here as to why we see so many new TV shows in the fall. So without further ado, let's just get into it. So, Madison, how do we deal with issues of free speech when it comes to hate groups?
I think it's really difficult for colleges, especially. It's a hard time balancing free speech and speech that takes away from inclusiveness and equality. Last week, Richard Spencer took a trip to the University of Florida. For those of you who don't know who Richard Spencer is, he is one of the biggest advocates for white supremacy in the United States.
So I know that Richard Spencer's name has been popping up a lot, especially in the alt-right movement and as well as just other coverage in the news. Can you tell me more about how Richard Spencer has been feeding in to this hate speech?
Yeah, definitely. So Spencer tries to target college campuses, and that's because college students can be curious and receptive to new, even radical ideas. Universities, by definition, have to welcome free speech and philosophies of every kind. It's law that publicly funded schools cannot prohibit free speech. So the reason why Richard Spencer can go to any school he wants is as long as he can pay the event fee, the college cannot turn him down just because their beliefs may be differing.
So how receptive have colleges been to Richard Spencer's message? Have they been welcoming? Have they been hostile? What's some of the trends that we've seen with this movement and hate speech on college campuses?
College students have honestly been feeding off of people like Richard Spencer, but in the opposite way that Spencer was probably hoping for. College campuses are a place where equality and inclusiveness seem to thrive, no matter your gender, your race, your sexuality. And I think our generation definitely is taking a stand for those continued rights. So when someone like Spencer comes onto a campus, students are going to take the initiative to show him that he is not welcome, even if the First Amendment right is bringing him to them. For example, at the University of Florida, students were there in protest. They had signs. They were chanting. Students actually bought tickets to fill up Spencer's auditorium that he was speaking in so that his real supporters could not hear his words. So the protesters were taking away Spencer's audience and chanting throughout his whole time on stage things like, "Go home, Spencer," and "We don't want your Nazi hate." I would definitely say that college students have been totally receptive in taking a stand for what they believe is right.
So in response to hate speech coming from people like Richard Spencer or the alt-right or other such hate groups, are we seeing violence become a norm as a response to their message, or are we seeing a more nonviolent response? What are we looking at there?
So definitely in response to Spencer, the counter-protest groups are trying to make their beliefs known in a nonviolent fashion. But unfortunately, it seems wherever Spencer goes, violence always somehow comes about. Like in Charlottesville, an alt-right member drove his car into a group of protesters, killing one woman and injuring others. Even after the University of Florida protest in Gainesville, there was a shot fired from a group of white supremacists at another group standing at a bus stop. So it seems that even though peaceful protests try to take place, it's difficult keeping the peaceful atmosphere just because of the weight of the topic.
And that was Madison Hoffman, our current news editor at The Carolinian. For our next segment, we are going to be exploring some rather murky political undertones. This is Draining the Swamp with Annie Walker.
All right, y'all, let's talk about a man named Ryan Zinke. Who exactly is this humble Montanian? He's the Secretary of the Interior for these United States, which is, you know, the department that you forgot existed. It's cool, I'll help you out. They manage our natural resources that we care so much about in the Trump administration. They work on climate change, apparently. They also do the National Park Service. Everybody loves national parks. And, you know, all of this sounds pretty sweet, right? Well, they also do some other stuff. Like working with the Department of Homeland Security on hurricane relief efforts. Yay, relief! Boo, hurricanes. One hurricane relief effort of particular interest is that related to Hurricane Maria, which, you know, was the one that battered the U.S. Virgin Islands and won Puerto Rico. Which, by the way, 80% of the island is still without power 1 month later. Great progress, guys. Being without electricity is clearly kind of a bummer for your ability to charge your iPhone, but it goes a lot beyond your ability to have the lights on and keep your appliances running. It also means that you can't run your water and sewer systems, which stop people from getting cholera and dying. Clearly very dangerous. But with all of this danger, you think the federal government's gonna do a lot to help fix this problem, right? Because there are 3.4 million Americans who are living in a place that mostly has no power. Pretty big problem. But, see, that isn't exactly the priority you think it is, because this administration is taking the issue of restoring Puerto Rico's electricity so seriously that they did not activate the mutual aid agreement that occurred between utility companies. This is how we normally get people's utilities back online, is that we ask for help, help comes, we fix things. Pretty cool, right? Well, that didn't happen this time. Instead, their commitment to best serving the 3.4 million Americans on the island led to the hire of a teeny tiny private company. Now, you may think that the normal way to hire private companies to do work for the government is through a bidding process, where the government looks at lots of companies and then picks the option that will best make use of your tax dollars. You're right! That does sound normal, but you're wrong if you thought that that's how this particular contract got handed out. Instead, a $300 million contract was given to one teeny tiny Whitefish Energy through private negotiations. That's right, $300 million. Backhand conversations. Great. Which leads to the next question, though. Who is Whitefish? Other than being the company tasked with repairing Puerto Rico's massive electric grid, they're also a new company of mostly subcontractors and two guys in Montana. Now, when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, the whole company was just two guys in Montana. Great! Since then, they've bulked up a fair amount and they have 280 subcontractors on the island, and those numbers are growing daily. But it still makes you wonder how they got the job. So what is a company based in a tiny town in Montana doing with a $300 million contract? That's a good question, and you might want to pose it to our friend, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Now, Whitefish, Montana isn't just the home of this company, it's also Secretary Zinke's hometown. And according to the comments on the matter given to the Washington Post, Zinke himself wasn't directly handling this matter. But whoever was directly handling this matter has a lot of questions to answer, because Congress is quite interested in what's happening with your tax dollars. And that's draining the swamp for ya.
That was Annie Walker, who currently serves as opinions editor for the Carolinian. With the World Series well underway, baseball fans are eagerly awaiting to see whether the Astros or the Dodgers will come out victorious. Let's see what our sports staff has to say.
Hello, this is Dan Johnson of the Carolinian. I'm here with Matt Kerr of WUAG, and we're here to discuss the World Series. Now, Matt, I'm not sure if you watched the game or not, but all I can say right now is Houston, I think we have a problem.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to see what Houston is made of. I think that Los Angeles, at least, has learned from past problems in their playoff runs, and they finally got to the World Series after, you think about a team that's had a lot of success but has not had much success in the postseason. And as much as you might point to maybe the Cubs in recent years and some other teams, obviously the Cubs getting over the hump last year, I think no team has had more success in postseason play in probably the last decade no team has had more regular season success with as much postseason futility as the Los Angeles Dodgers have had. They've seemed to be a perennial team who makes the playoffs and are ousted each year in the first or second round. Clayton Kershaw, their incredible ace, has had his problems in the playoffs.
Oh, yeah.
But he appears to be getting it on the right track. And I think that, you know, Houston might put up some runs, might win a couple games in this series. And obviously, as we're recording it, it's 1-0 right now in the series score, with the Los Angeles Dodgers leading it. I think that the Houston Astros can make it interesting, but I just kind of feel like this is LA's year.
Well, even with the Chicago Cubs comparisons, the Cubs really only had a two-year period to win a championship. They got to the postseason in 2015, and then they won. With the Dodgers, they've been to four straight postseasons where they've won the National League West. They got ousted twice in the NLDS and ousted twice in the NLCS. This is a team that's been just had trouble going far in the postseason. And you know what? When regular season Clayton Kershaw start looking like postseason Clayton Kershaw, that's a great thing, because the player that I always compare them to is Peyton Manning. And this team is very much like the Colts when Peyton Manning was leading it. They're a team that will look amazing in the regular season, and they have this amazing star that, who's leading the team. And then they all just go down when it comes to the postseason. And I always find that a bit humorous. I'm like, is it because it's cold? Is it because you're facing bad competition? I don't know what's going on. But as you said, as we're recording this, it's after game one. The Dodgers won 3-1, and Houston's lineup could not do anything against Kershaw. This is a lineup that led the league in hits, OPS, RBIs, basically any offensive category there is in baseball when it comes to hitting. The Astros led the league in that. The Astros have been probably the most consistent team all year. They got off to a hot start going to the All-Star break, and even after they had maybe a couple weeks of cooling down, they still maintained a level of excellence that has led them to get to this point.
I mean, I will kind of combat you on one thing. Yes, Clayton Kershaw has had some struggles in the postseason, but he's also had some really good postseason performances. And I think to kind of put LA's plague or LA's problems on Clayton Kershaw is not necessarily fair to Clayton Kershaw. Yes, he had a game 6 of the NLCS last year where he gave up 5 runs in 5 innings to the Cubs, and it was the game clinching loss that the Cubs went on to the World Series. But as well, you know, he also had some pretty epic performances in that same series got a save in at least I forget if it was the NLDS or the NLCS. I think it was in the NLDS actually. He got a save in the in game clinching in game five, came out and got the save to move them to the NLCS. So I think when you talk about Kershaw and talk about, you know, him regular season to postseason, yes, he has had a few games where he's struggled, but I think that people highlight that a little bit too much. He's also had a lot of games where he's played quite well, quite similarly to his regular season performances.
I understand your point, and I'm not trying to put the entire run of Dodgers futility in the postseason on Kershaw's shoulder, but I've noticed a lot of difference in postseason Clayton Kershaw and regular season Clayton Kershaw. Going to his postseason, he has had he had a 4-7 record with a over 4 ERA, which that's you cut that in half of Kershaw in the regular season. In 162 games, he only has probably 4 or 5 losses, and his ERA is cut in half. Now, I would say this about the Dodgers' bats. They I'm not going to say they really showed up. They only scored 3 runs. Dallas Keuchel pitched a really good performance in his part, but Justin Turner looks he looks one of those players who looks good in the regular season and then just is amazing in the postseason. I don't know how to compare him, maybe to Cody Ross from a few years ago. Jeter-like, but not at the same level. But he hit the go-ahead 2-run home run that made the difference in the game. You got the return of Corey Seager at shortstop, who he missed all of the NLCS with his hamstring injury. And then he immediately came out and went 2-for-4, which is impressive. Before Cody Bellinger was the rookie sensation for the Dodgers this year, it was Corey Seager last year. This guy is less than 3 years in baseball. He's already probably a top 3 shortstop in the league. Now, it's only game one. We don't know what's going to happen for the rest of the series. Maybe when Kershaw plays again, he'll throw a no-hitter. Maybe next time he won't be able to get out the first inning. But what matters is what's going to happen for the rest of the pitching staff. One matchup I really want to see is a matchup between the trade deadline moves that these two teams made. You got Verlander pitching game two for the Houston Astros, who's trying to even up the series, and they probably really need to even up the series. And then you got Yu Darvish pitching game three in Houston, which he faced Houston a lot of times when he was with Texas. Then I want to see how he does against his old rival.
And that's another guy who, you look at it, hey, Verlander does not have a World Series either and has been there a lot of times. And
he does not.
And, I mean, do you see a difference between postseason Verlander and regular season Verlander?
The only time Justin Verlander looks like regular season Verlander is when he's facing the Oakland A's. For some reason, because I'm not an A's fan, but I do like watching the A's in the postseason, and every time they make the postseason, they used to play the Tigers. Verlander just looked like he was going to throw a no-hitter every time he faced this team. But you make a point there. Like, I can't imagine pitching on that level in the postseason. Plus, when it's really cold out there. It's because it's October baseball. It's going to get kind of windy. It's going to get kind of cold. Your arm's going to tighten up a little bit. You're pitching on short rest. You don't have the ability to go deeper in counts, because a lot of these teams like driving off the pitch count just to get to the bullpen. So I can't imagine pitching in these series, but what's really not helping their cases is the fact that Madison Bumgarner looks like Hercules every time he pitches in a postseason game.
Yeah, Bumgarner is quite an asset. Now, wait a second. Am I off? Where is Bumgarner playing now? He's still for the Giants, right?
Yeah, he has 3 World Series rings, so I think he can take a year off every now and then.
Well, yeah, it used to be every odd year. What was it that the Giants? Yeah. But you're saying just against Verlander, he met him in multiple postseason times, and then even when Verlander pitched a good game, Bumgarner pitched a better one.
Actually, not. I remember Verlander pitched Game 1 of the 2014 World Series, and that was the game when Pablo Sandoval hit 3 home runs off of him.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, I think that Kershaw's the one that kind of gets the brunt of, oh, he's not that good in the postseason. But I think that there are a lot of pitchers like that. And so I think it's a little unfair. And like I say, I think that he's, for his few terrible performances. He's also had some great performances as well. All right, so I think the big thing that I want to know, and you said Houston, we have a problem. Do you think that we already should crown a World Series champ? Do you think that LA is going to end up winning their first World Series since I don't even know how long?
1988.
Okay, there you go.
I picked Los Angeles in this series before it began. I had them in six games because I really liked it. I really liked their pitching, and to me, that Houston has better hitters. But the Dodgers aren't no slouch when it comes to hitting themselves. So that's why I like the fact I like the Dodgers going to this series. Now, Houston, the series doesn't begin until the home team loses. That was the saying in the NBA. That's the saying in MLB. I would like to see what Houston does against the Dodgers in game two. And I'll also like to see what the Dodgers would do in Houston because Houston has a really good home field advantage. That being said, I also like the fact they have Yu Darvish pitching games three. I think that's a smart move for having the better pitcher, the veteran pitcher, the guy who's more used to pitching a postseason atmosphere when he was with the Rangers, and who's more common pitching against the Astros in the home field. So I do believe Houston's going to lose tonight, lose game two, and then I do have the Dodgers. I would say the Dodgers is probably going to split. Take one out of three in Houston before going back to Los Angeles to close it out.
So still in six games. All right, I'm going to see your six and lower you one. Ah, you see what I did that? Not raise you one. I don't think it's going seven games. I think that LA just feels, I feel the momentum swinging in their favor. And I think that they're a little bit more... they're a little bit more desperate. You know, as you talked about, Houston's a young team. It's kind of surprising that they've already ascended to this level. And, I mean, it's not surprising given their statistics from this season, but you just don't typically see a team this young play so well in the postseason. And I think it finally catches up with them in this series. I do think they take game four, but I think that the Dodgers end up taking game five. I believe it, Kershaw may actually even be back for game five. Or actually, he might even pitch game four.
Game four, game five, depending if you're going with the three-man rotation or the four-man rotation.
Yeah, and it honestly, I think if Kershaw pitches game four, I think they close it out. They sweep
a sweep. Oh,
yeah, because I think that exactly what we talked about. Kershaw, you know, he's got a monkey on his back, and he just wants to get that off his back. He does not want the definition of him to be, well, he's a great regular season pitcher. He doesn't want that asterisk. He wants to be considered a great pitcher. And after this series, he will get that distinction with a World Series and possibly even a MVP award if he pitches a really good game four and game one. So that's my prediction.
And I guess LA is back now. You got Lonzo with the Lakers, and now you got the Dodgers might win a World Series.
So what do celebrities like Susan Boyle, Justin Bieber, and Bo Burnham all have in common? They all started their career on YouTube. One person who has also seen their own rise to fame through YouTube is Froggy Fresh, formerly known as Krispy Kreme, who got famous for this.
Y'all already know, 'cause I am the baddest of them all. If you ain't about money, then I don't mess with y'all. Y'all think I don't get girls, 'cause I ain't very tall. If she see my stacks, I bet you that she calls. You know that I am the baddest of them all.
Froggy Fresh recently did a performance here at UNCG, and Sam Ha had a chance to sit down with him at the WAG radio station.
Do you have any new material you've been working on?
Kind of. I'm talking to a producer about doing a TV show. A Froggy Fresh style TV show. There's also some other stuff that I've been working on, some other musical stuff outside of Froggy Fresh.
Is it still within the realm of rap, or is it like...
No.
What genres have you been working with?
I wrote some like pop soul music.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm excited. Is that going to come out anytime soon?
I have no idea. I want it to.
Still in the vault.
I want it to. It's just when the time's right.
Do you have a favorite beat by any producer ever?
You know, I really like Shook Ones the instrumental that's in 8 Mile, which is so cliche, yeah. Which is super cliche because it's like, but that's actually like a really good instrumental.
It is definitely. What is the reasoning behind such large quantities in your lyrics, such as 400 houses?
It was a parody houses. It was a parody of the excess and like in rap culture. Yeah.
Yeah. Why does everyone get scared when you front flip? Is it particularly menacing or?
That was, I feel like people probably don't. I feel like, I just felt like saying that.
Is there any new music you've been listening to that's come out?
You know, on tour, like the people in my van, like my DJ, like Justin, everybody in my van, except for like me and Moneymaker Mike, are not big music connoisseurs, but everyone in our van, like our tour manager, Philip, mm-hmm. and our driver, Johnny, and our DJ, Justin, they know so much about music. So, like, we listened to, like through this tour, like, I've probably listened to more music in the last 5 weeks than I have like in the last, like, life. 5 years.
Dang. So it's been pretty good.
Yeah.
The tour mix?
Yeah, the tour's great.
Ooh. Have you ever toured North Carolina before?
This was the first show. This was actually my first time I ever did a musical performance was in April.
Wow.
Yeah, that was the first time I was ever on a stage musically.
Well, it was nice talking with you, Froggy.
Hey,
Fresh.
You too, bro.
This one's for the club. I've been shot about 500 times, and I've done about 1 million crimes. I killed a great white shark. I knocked out his teeth, and I ripped out his heart. Talk crap, and I'll give you a scar. Talk crap, I'll throw eggs at your car.
Now, looking into why so many shows either premiere or return in the fall, we spoke with Dr. Yin Young, who is an adjunct professor of media studies here at UNCG. So I guess we'll get right into it. So we do see a bunch of new shows being released typically in the fall season. So what are some of the reasons behind all these new premieres?
Okay, well, the television season starts in September of every year because it's usually after a long summer break. So they're premiering a lot of new shows. We see some new series that the networks are promoting heavily on. Like there's a Will and Grace reunion show that NBC is really promoting heavily this fall season. But we also see some returning shows that have been doing very well, and they will continue their second season or more season on in the fall. So we see both returning shows and new shows.
Okay. How has this paradigm, has it ever fluctuated? Is it starting to change? What are some aspects of that?
Actually, it is. We do see some changes in that because one of the shows that people always talk about is Game of Thrones on HBO. That show actually does not premiere in the fall. That show premieres in, I think this year they started in April. And before September, they have wrapped up their whole season already. So this is something that we usually don't see that happening to very popular shows. HBO has their own reasons for doing that, you know, because of the shooting schedule is different. And they also want to avoid the heavy competition in the fall. So they want to do it earlier and also give them something to look forward to in the summer when everyone else is just doing reruns. But because of that, Game of Thrones this year was not qualified to be considered for the Emmys awards. So that's something that is out of ordinary. So.
So one thing that I know that network executives look for is the marketability of shows. So what exactly are some elements that networks look for when they're picking up a show or are continuing a show?
Okay. Well, we say a good show may not make money. And the shows that are all on TV right now may not all be good shows. Because it's not only about the quality of the show, but also about the profitability of the show. I'll give you several examples. Fox Network, several years ago, had a show called Terra Nova. Some of us still remember maybe seeing the promos for that because they really invested a lot of money for that show. It's a kind of sci-fi futuristic show, similar to even the movie Jurassic Park. And it cost them a lot of money. The first episode, 2-hour premiere, costed between $10 and $20 million. The show came out. It was a great show, high quality, really good performance, but it only ran for one season. Why? Because the production cost is not fully recovered by all the advertising revenue that they were able to generate from the show. So when we look for a show, it's not only about whether or not it's a decent show, it's also about whether or not the show can make money.
Okay. So there's this kind of balance between creativity and marketability?
Right, definitely. And that's a very delicate balance they're trying to hit. Another popular show, The Big Bang Theory, which is one of my favorite. You think about it, 22 minutes, that's it. But the show, it's in its 11th season already, and just to pay for the salaries of those actors, they have to write a multi-billion paycheck just for that. The three lead actors and actresses are getting $1 million for just one episode, so that's a lot. But how is the show still going on and they actually have been renewed for another 3 years? It's because a show can be sold on so many different platforms. They're doing new episodes on CBS. The show has gone into syndication on TBS. They can also sell DVDs. The sale has been great on that. And also the advertising price for the commercial spot during the show is one of the highest that we see in broadcast television. So you think about it, it's just a comedy. But because it's so popular and can be marketed in so many different ways, it's a very strong and profitable show for CBS.
Okay. So obviously different networks employ certain marketing strategies. There's one example, I know Hammocking is placing a new show in between two successful shows. And that. So what are some shows or maybe examples of other marketing strategies that networks use to boost ratings and things like that?
Right. Networks are very creative and smart about when to schedule the programs that they have. The one thing that they usually do is to put a new show right after a established show. And this is called tentpoling, kind of like you're pulling up the tent on one end. They did this with The Big Bang Theory. CBS has a new show called Young Sheldon, which is a spinoff of The Big Bang Theory. What a spinoff is that they take one character from that show and develops a separate series just based on that character. So they took the Sheldon Cooper character from The Big Bang Theory and did a sitcom about his childhood called Young Sheldon. And guess where they put that show? They put it right after The Big Bang Theory. So that's a perfect example of tentpoling. It's a programming strategy we use a lot in television. Another thing that they do is blocking. Basically, they would put the same kind of show together, maybe for a 2 or 3 hour block, so hoping that the audiences would just stay on and continue to watch these similar shows. You can see that on the Thursday evening lineup on ABC. They've got Grey's Anatomy. They've got How to Get Away with Murder and Scandal. And these are very female-oriented drama shows, and they actually call it Thank God It's Thursday. That's their Thank God It's Thursday lineup. So very female-oriented shows. That's
good. So obviously, one thing that just keeps becoming more and more prevalent is Netflix, Hulu, Amazon. It seems that everyone is beginning to either know someone or actually have one of these streaming sites. So how are these streaming sites affecting the television industry with all this instant gratification that we get from those?
A lot, I would say, besides binge watching and watching TV shows on a different platform, they actually are bringing a big threat to the traditional television industry. On one side, this year at the Emmys Awards, the best drama actually went to Hulu, which is an online streaming service. This is the first time that a show carried by an online streaming service has won Best Drama. Netflix has tried to do that in the past with House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, but they never won. This year, The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu won a Best Drama. So this shows that, hey, these services are no longer just providing a platform. They're also developing their own original series that poses as a great competition to the networks. The other thing that we have seen is even the producers are considering working with these online platforms. Shonda Rhimes, she is a very prominent showrunner. She's the one that created Grey's Anatomy, How to Get Away with Murder, Scandal on ABC. She recently jumped ship to join Netflix and signed a contract with them to develop Netflix original series. And one of the things that she said why she left ABC is because Netflix could give her more space, more freedom, more ways that she can push the envelope a little bit more.
Yeah. So we're seeing the creatives behind all these shows starting to move and towards these online formats.
She's one of the most prominent figures that we have seen that has moved to the online platform. We don't know if the trend will continue. It is possible. So we want to see whether or not other big name producers or showrunners would show an interest in working with these online platform services.
So with all these new developments in the online platforms, what do you think is next for the TV industry?
Well, I think we will see the day where more people have online video services rather than cable. You know, if 10 years ago we were talking about cutting the cord, now we're talking about definitely majority of the people that I know have cut the cord. It will be challenging, I would say, for some of the TV networks. The other thing is because they're all developing the shows, so they're competing for the creative people as well. So online platforms sometimes have the advantage because they are more independent, they're newer, so they could afford to be a little bit more savvy, a little bit more innovative than the traditional networks. Yeah, I look forward to see what else they can come up with.
Well, thank you again. Well, guys, that's the end of the first show, and I just want to say thanks again to everyone that made it possible. The people that produced this show are Matt Kerr, Madison Hoffman, Daniel Johnson, Annie Walker, Sam Ha, and me, Ross Kiefer. The show is edited by Sam Ha, Matt Kerr, and once again, me. And the music you heard this hour was by The Bronze Chorus, Topher Moore and Alex Elena, Froggy Fresh, and Kings of Leon. You can tweet at us at The Carolinian on Twitter. You can visit our website, carolinianuncg.com. And until next time, stay curious.